from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll meet Mike Mullen, the author of the young adult novel Ashfall.
I'll find out what's next for the Indiana Ballet Conservatory.
And I'll get a preview of the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra's next concert. And we'll have our arts calendar we call
What do we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. If you, or the teens in your life perhaps, like The Hunger Games, you're doubtless aware that post-apocalyptic thrillers are wildly popular. Well, Indianapolis author Mike Mullen has created a brave new dystopian world following a natural disaster, and Sharon Gamble invited Mike to tell us about his novel Ashfall, beginning with a reading. In the excerpt you're about to hear, teenaged Alex has been allowed to stay home alone for the weekend for the first time while his family takes a trip. Alex is excited about eating junk food and playing video games until...
There was a rumble, almost too low to hear, and the house shook a little. An earthquake, maybe, although we never have earthquakes in Iowa. The power went out. I stood to open the curtains. I thought there might be enough light to read by, at least for a while. Then it happened. I heard a cracking noise, like the sound the hackberry tree in our backyard had made when Dad cut it down last year, but louder, a forest of hackberries breaking together. The floor tilted, and I fell across the suddenly angled room, my arms and legs flailing. I screamed, but couldn't hear myself over the noise. A boom, and then a whistling sound, incoming artillery from a war movie, but played in reverse. My back hit the wall on the far side of the room, and the desk slid across the floor toward me. I wrapped myself into a ball, hands over the back of my neck, praying my desk wouldn't crush me. It rolled, painfully clipped my right shoulder, and came to rest above me, forming a small triangular space between the floor and the wall. I heard another crash, and everything shook violently for a second. I lay in that triangular cave for a minute, maybe longer. My body mostly quit shaking, and the ringing in my ears began to fade. I poked my right shoulder gingerly. It felt swollen, and touching it hurt. I could move the arm a little, though, so I figured it wasn't broken. I might have lain there longer, checking my injuries. But I smelled something burning.
Oh, boy, that's a great place to leave our listeners hanging. And I know you've been touring a lot in support of the book, and
yes.
Forgive me, but I'm probably going to ask some of the same questions you get regularly.
Oh, that's quite okay.
First of all, this could happen.
Yes, it in fact will happen someday. One thing all geologists agree upon is that there is an active volcano under Yellowstone. It is, in fact, what powers all those geysers and mud baths and all the things that those of us who visited Yellowstone are familiar with. It last erupted 640,000 years ago. Nobody knows when it will erupt again, but everyone agrees that it will.
And it has erupted multiple times over the millennia.
Yes, that's right. Actually,
so we might be
three times in the last 2.1 million years and hundreds of times over the last several hundred million years.
So we might be due.
Sometimes you'll see programs on TV that say we're due for another eruption. They're basing that on the fact that the last three eruptions appear to have a regular interval. There was an eruption 2.1 million years ago, one 1.3 million years ago, and one 640,000 years ago. But what they don't tell you is that the eruption preceding those three was 4.2 million years ago. And so the regularity of the last three events is deceptive. Nobody knows when it will erupt again. But every geologist I talk to agrees that it will erupt again. I hope it doesn't happen in our lifetimes. I'd prefer to be long dead and buried.
That's right. You'd prefer not to go through the adventures of your protagonist here.
Absolutely.
So
I don't think I could survive, for one thing, as he does.
Well, it's the rigor of the science. I mean, you've done your homework here, and it's just astonishing to think, in particular, of the amount of ash put into the atmosphere and the coverage of it.
Yeah. Do you recall the Mount St. Helens eruption in,
yes,
in 1980? Yeah. So, you know, that massive eruption, ash raining for days. In fact, months afterwards, there were little secondary eruptions that put new ash falls down in Seattle and Idaho and all over. Well, the Yellowstone super eruption of 640,000 years ago, mm-hmm, put down 2,000 times as much ash.
Wow.
2,000 times. It laid down enough ash to cover the entire state of California 6 meters deep.
And there are climatologists who say that even Mount St. Helens, which is weeny by
comparison
to the event that that launches this book, so to speak, changed our climate forever.
Yeah, absolutely. And an eruption of Yellowstone would change the climate drastically. There's one theory called the Toba catastrophe theory that holds that the super eruption of Mount Toba in Indonesia 77,000 years ago was the trigger that led to an ice age. Mm-hmm. And in fact, at about that same time, the human race, we know from the genetic record, narrowed down to about 32 individuals. And so Toba, a supervolcano, may well have very nearly done in the human race once before. Now, that theory is controversial. It's not proven, but it's certainly interesting to speculate
sure,
about.
Sure, it's fascinating. So how do you, it's radio, so people can't see you, but they probably detect by your voice that you're a grown man.
Oh, yeah.
How did you get in the mind of Alex, who grows up, I have to warn you, grows up quite a bit through the several hundred pages of
this
book?
Yes, absolutely.
How did you know this character?
Well, there are a couple ways I look at character. One is there's an external side to the character. And for my external model, I used Ben Alexander, who is a young man I met when I started taking Taekwondo. I started taking Taekwondo about 4 years ago as part of the research for this book. I knew I wanted my main character to be a martial artist. And so the easiest way to write that correctly was to become a martial artist myself. And I met Ben Alexander, who at the time was 15, a third-degree black belt, and he's just a wonderful, patient, kind guy, but also just can pretty much kick me in the head as often as he wants to. Much better martial artist than I am even now. And so I named Alex after Ben Alexander, and he was the external model for my character. The internal model is really my own memories of my own childhood, and Alex is very much internally myself.
Alex is celebrating when we first meet him in the book. He's excited because he's been allowed to stay home alone for essentially a long weekend for the first time in his life, while his parents and his pesky sister go off a couple of 3 hours away to visit some relatives. And he's thrilled. He's going to play video games and eat hot dogs or, you know, just have a blast.
Like I said, me as a teenager.
Okay.
I would have loved that.
But it doesn't last long.
No.
And after the things, I can't really say settle down because things never settle down from the volcano and the ash fall because things keep happening, things keep developing, both geological things and human things. But you send him on an adventure. It's one part coming of age novel, but it's also very much an adventure.
Absolutely,
novel.
Yeah.
How did you decide? Did you chart this all out, or did this just come to you as you were writing?
I planned the novel beforehand. I knew it would be a quest story, you know, like Odysseus or Gilgamesh or any of the, you know, any of the quest stories. There's always a hero who's searching for something he's lost, in this case his family. And I planned it all out ahead of time, but I didn't stick to a tight outline. I used a very rough outline. I moved stuff around, deleted stuff. Some of the best parts of the novel what I think are the best parts of the novel were never in the outline, were added as I was writing. And in fact, I found out that I'd written some things into the novel that I had no idea I was putting in there.
Really? For example?
People had often asked me where Target came from, who's one of the villains of the story. And I've always said, I have no idea. It came somewhere deep in my subconscious. I don't know anyone like that, thank goodness. He's a pretty horrible guy. And then I was visiting Armonk, New York, a library in Armonk, New York, a couple weeks ago. And Mary Johnson, the librarian there, said, oh, so you base Target off of Polyphemus, right? And I'm like, I remember Polyphemus is part of the Odyssey, but I haven't read the Odyssey in, you know, 25
years
at least. And I don't think so. And that night in my hotel room, I'm looking up summaries of the plot and rereading sections of it online, and I realized I completely did. Not consciously at all, but Odysseus overcomes Polyphemus by stabbing him in the eye, which is exactly what happens with Alex and Targa. Polyphemus is described as having a coil of hair that wraps around the back of his head, like the target tattooed on Target's head. And Odysseus can't defeat Polyphemus with his strength, so he outthinks him. He hides in these sheepskins. And similarly, Alex winds up outthinking Target. And so I completely did. I rewrote a section of the Odyssey into my book, and I had no idea I was doing it. It's just lurked there in my subconscious for 25 years, I guess.
You've just done all the English teachers in our listenership a favor.
Yeah, I suppose I have. I mean,
kids, pay attention. You might, you're thinking, why do I have to read this? You might use it later in your life. Who knows?
Absolutely.
I know that this novel is aimed at young adults, but it's a fascinating read for people of any age. However, I remember thinking at several points, as a grown woman, this is really gross, but if I were a teenage boy, I would so love this.
Yeah.
The graphic quality of the violence. There's some kind of disturbing stuff in here, which of course teen boys in particular would love. How did you write the novel and then go back and say, let me alter the language here and here and here and tweak it and make it more appealing to a kid? Or was there some way that you got in a particular mindset? I know you've worked around sources of young people's fiction, like with Kids Inc., the bookstore.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
But was there some sort of trick of the trade that allowed you to write as though you were talking specifically to kids?
In terms of the violence, I just felt like it was more honest. I mean, I always think writing a teenage audience, the important thing to do is be as brutally honest as I possibly can be. I mean, I think any kind of fakery is instantly obvious. And I felt like it was more honest to write the violence as realistically as I could. You know, if I glossed over those parts, and I feel like I'm doing a little bit of a disservice to my readers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I consciously tried to be graphic and descriptive and to not play down the violence, and so that it would feel hopefully real. Hopefully as you read it, it feels very, very real, every part of it. And I think that's important because I think it's, when violence becomes sort of cartoonish and with no consequences and no realistic emotional or physical consequences, then I think we use it more casually, and I don't want my work to have that effect.
Right.
And so I think it's important to write it realistically, and that's why I did. I think teen readers are generally very well informed, smart readers. I think they know more now than I certainly did when I was growing up. Probably each generation seems to be better informed than the one previous, and so the trick in writing for teens isn't to make your writing simpler. It's to make it clear, but also you write up to teenagers, not down to them. You write your absolute best stuff, and that's what I've attempted to do.
I love too that you allow Alex, and I don't want to give too much away here, but he encounters a companion along the way who is able to share some of the challenges, and in fact she has a number of skills that he does not have.
Mm-hmm.
But you allow him to be vulnerable and tender, not just towards Darla, but also towards his family that he's missing, that he's trying to find.
And that was one of the surprises that as I was writing. I really thought Alex, he starts out as a sort of naive, fairly innocent, sheltered, his biggest fights have always been with his mother.
Sure.
And teenager. And he has to grow into something else to be able to survive. And I always thought he would become tougher and more jaded and a little more cynical as he went. And as I was writing him, he really didn't. If anything, he became kinder. And I thought about that a lot and liked it and left it that way. I'm not sure why it worked out that way exactly. That wasn't particularly my plan, But I like that.
But it feels real.
I would hope that some of us would respond that way in an apocalypse.
Again, not to give too much away, but Alex succeeds in part of his quest, but not all of his quest.
Right.
And you've kind of left the door open to a sequel.
Absolutely. Ashen Winter is the sequel, and it will be out on October 8th. And you can see the cover at my website or any of your favorite booksellers. It's just released, and there's an excerpt. The first two chapters are up already on my website.
Have you finished writing it already?
Yeah, Oh, yes. I'm very fortunate in that Tanglewood Press, before Ashfall had even sold, I offered to write the sequel and asked if they'd be interested in buying it. And I figured they'd probably... say, no, let's wait. Let's see how Ashfall does.
Sure.
But instead, they mailed me a contract and a check.
What a vote of confidence.
Yeah, which is awesome. Now I've got this check. I've just got to write the book. So I've been working on Ashen Winter now for the last year and a half. And it's actually the advanced reading copies are already out there. But we're just going through the very last phase of the proofreading, you know, the galley proofs now. And so, yeah, it'll be out October 8th, and there'll also be a paperback of Ashfall, and it's very exciting. And, and I have a commitment for the third and final book in the trilogy, too,
which I've started
working on. I've written the first three chapters and an outline of the whole novel, so now I just got to finish it. I expect that will take about a year.
Sharon Gamble with Indianapolis novelist Mike Mullen. Ashfall was named one of the top five young adult novels by NPR for 2011. You can learn lots more about Ashfall at his website, MikeMullenAuthor.com. That's Mike, M-U-L-L-I-N, author.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. This May, the Indiana Ballet Conservatory will be performing Cipollino, a ballet about fruits and vegetables that's never been performed. Until now, in Indianapolis. Travis DiNicola spoke with Alonia Yakuleva, their artistic director, and Camille Nicodemus, executive director, about this production.
So I'm excited about talking about this ballet, Cipollino, that's never been performed before in Indianapolis. But before we get to that, let's talk a bit about the conservatory, what you do, who you are, the students you work with, all that. Camille, I'll start with you.
Sure, absolutely. We are the Indiana Ballet Conservatory, and we're a pre-professional dance academy that teaches ballet, jazz, modern, contemporary, and a number of other types of dance. We focus on the Vaganova method, which is a 300-year-old tradition started in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a world-class faculty of Alona Yakovleva, Tatiana Pali, Sergei Sergeyev, and Haley Agron, all of whom have had incredible careers, both in professional dancing as well as in teaching, and
yes.
have won many, many awards at international ballet competitions. So we are really, really proud of our faculty at Indiana Ballet Conservatory. And we also are really pleased to announce that we just moved into brand new studios at 849 West Carmel Drive, which is just...
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We're really, really excited. Yeah.
I bet.
We're almost finished with the complete build-out. And we are just east of Meridian on West Carmel Drive, and we've got four beautiful studios with brand new professional sprung flooring, which is fantastic for the professional training of our students, and we're holding master classes there regularly now, which is great. So we're super excited about that.
And you just moved in there, so it's not all complete yet,
well,
but you are having some classes there?
We moved in January, and
okay.
we've been operating on a full spring schedule. So
okay.
we're just putting the finishing touches on all of the decor and putting up all of our information and all that, and we are having a grand opening, an official grand opening with a ribbon cutting on May 20th, and the general public is invited to come. That starts at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We're going to be doing a little short performance so you can see the talent of our dancers, meet our faculty, learn a little bit more about the program itself, and kind of see what we have going on there. But yeah, we've been actively dancing in the new studios all spring.
Give me that location one more time, please.
Sure. It's 849 West Carmel Drive, which is just east of Meridian Street. If you're coming off of West Carmel Drive, you turn right on Hancock, and if you come on that Sunday, we'll have balloons out, so you won't miss us.
Good. So you're no longer gypsies or squatters, right?
No.
No, that's terrific to have your own space. I know what a difference that makes. And it sounds great. So you said you've got four studios there
yeah.
and with the sprung floor, so, which is, of course, easier on the dancers' knees and,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
such. And, well, that's terrific. Congratulations on
Thank
that.
You.
And your students, I mean, it's a pre-professional training, but you have students of all ages.
That's correct. We have students from age 3 to 18. And we also are really proud of our boys program. We have a lot of gentlemen students as well, running through all ages. So we have the opportunity to teach at a wonderful level because we've got both talented girls and boys. We can teach partnering at the more senior levels. And so it's just a really wonderful group of very, very talented kids.
That makes a big difference, it being does. Able to offer that as well, because that's obviously a big part of ballet performance. But I know some schools struggle with getting enough guys in there. So that's great that you have that. Do you also have adult classes, too, at all?
We sure do. We do. We have adult ballet classes. And we're also going to be expanding our programs in our fall semester, which begins in August. To offer some additional adult classes as well.
Okay, very good. Now, your spring performance, Alonia, I think you had something to do with choosing this. It's an Italian ballet, is that correct?
It's Russian ballet.
It is Russian, okay.
But it's based on very famous Italian fairy tale. It's famous writer Gianni Radari. All kids love this ballet. It's really, really family friendly. And it's lots of entertaining.
It's about vegetables and fruit.
Yes.
I mean, it sounds both silly and adorable.
Right. Yes. It's lots of eggplants and pumpkin and little green pieces and blueberries dancing. And generally, it's a story about a little onion boy named Cipollina.
An onion boy. Okay.
Yes. It's wonderful costumes as well. Mm-hmm. He's fighting for his friend against Lord Tomato and Prince Lemon.
Okay.
And it's like it's timeless message. It's about friendship. It's about support each other. It's about fight against unjustment. You know, it just fight for your rights, never give up, and be a good person again. But it's lots of great choreography, and I love this ballet personally. It's one of my favorite. And I think kids will enjoy it, and adults as well. Music is fantastic.
Yeah, tell me about the music for this.
Music, it's Khachaturian, but it's not famous Khachaturian what wrote music for Spartacus. It's Khachaturian. Actually, it's his son who wrote this music for that ballet. But it's beautiful. It's lots of fun, and it's lots of stories inside the music.
I mean, it sounds like very up music, very just sort of fun.
Oh, yes.
What are the costumes like? I mean, I've heard of course, when I hear that, you know, onion boy and the tomato and the lemon and you know, I mean, I'm thinking, I have certainly some ideas here, but what are the costumes like and who does them for you?
Well, we have lots of volunteers. We have a very big supportive group of parents who help in our costume mistress. And her name is
Joyce.
She's fantastic. We've been working already with couple productions with her. And her creativity is absolutely phenomenal. She creating like little headpieces, like green pieces, like for green pieces, for corns, for carrots, and it all this, it's cactus, even cactus dancing. And she showing me every day with lots of excitement what's new coming today. And kids and students, I'm not allowed to call them by names anymore, because if I'm saying, Emily, come here. She's saying, no, I'm not Emily. I'm Blueberry.
Of course.
Right.
Now, when I think of blueberries and onions and tomatoes and lemons, I think of costumes that might be kind of large and bulbous and that cover up a lot of the body, which doesn't really work in ballet. This is not the case, right? We're not talking like these huge dancing onions or blueberries on the stage.
No. No, it's like a cute touch for head, and it's like costume more
the Fruit of the Loom guys here. I don't know if you know that reference, but this is not what we're thinking of. Okay.
No, it's all about grace and beauty, and students will look fantastic.
They're great. And just a quick shout out to Joyce Fitzpatrick and Michelle Wilson, who are doing a lot of the sewing and the designing the costumes, and they really are beautiful and cute. We're so excited.
Camille, what do you think of this ballet? This is your first encounter with it?
It is. I think it's fantastic. I'm really, really excited because it is new. And there are a lot of beautiful and wonderful ballets out there. I've been a lifelong fan of the ballet, so I've seen many of them many times. What's really neat about this is that it is something new and different. And as Alona pointed out, the messages are really timeless. It's a great story. It's wonderful for families and kids. And it's just a visually, colorful And fun, especially for springtime. So I hope everybody comes out to see it. It's going to be at our the theater that we regularly perform at now, which is the Tobias Theater at the Indianapolis
Museum.
Right
at the Toby.
May 12th at 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. and 7 p.m. And you can get tickets on our website at IndianaBalletConservatory.org.
So two performances, and it sounds like it is a great ballet for younger kids. I mean, for families to take young kids to see.
I think it's great ballet just for all family. Adults will enjoy as well as little kids. It's just absolutely adorable ballet.
Well, it sounds fun. And certainly, it's a great thing for parents who are considering getting their kids involved in ballet. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing I always recommend is go see some of the ballet companies. And so go see this performance. And if, your son or daughter are engaged in watching it, then this, could be the right school for you.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. We have lots of different style of dance, like usually we do. It's classical duet, it's contemporary, it's character dance, it's lots of different styles.
Well, very good. It just sounds like a lot of fun. Who is your onion boy? I have to ask.
It's Sterling Munkar. Actually, he's right now in New York. Mm-hmm. He's actually competing in the Youth American Grand Prix, larger international ballet competition in the world, and as well.
That's fantastic. So he's got some great experience.
Absolutely. Soon he will be back. We will have very intensive preparation for Cipollina, and we will perform right in the May 12th. Yes, and also we have another 25 students who right now in New York as well. So they all represent in Indianapolis.
That's very good. Very good to hear. So a lot of your students are out there competing and succeeding and doing great. And, of course, so Cipollina is a great opportunity to showcase their work as well. When is the next time for enrollment for students?
Well, we have we're just finishing up our spring semester, and we are going to have a really, really exciting summer at Indiana Ballet Conservatory. We've got camps. We've got half-day camps for little kids, 3 and 4 years old, 5 and 6, where they can engage in little dancing, some crafts, some music, and a lot of fun. Those will have themes based on various ballets. So there'll be the Nutcracker, Capella, Swan Lake, and all of that fun stuff. And the kids have an absolutely wonderful time. We also have classes ongoing through June for all of our age group, all of our kids 3 to 18. We've got our season of summer intensives, which is for the more serious-minded student in the month of July. And that's an entire day. You can sign up by the week. So four weeks running. But that's an entire day of intensive training, and you get really a golden opportunity to be with this incredible faculty and develop your skills. So we're really excited to have a big program going on this summer.
Great.
We also have evening classes, what's open for all different ages and abilities. So we really have a lot to offer this summer in IBC. It's very excited.
Very good, very good. And you don't have to dress up as an onion.
No.
I'm just teasing. So, Alonia, Camille, it's always a pleasure to chat with you both, and great work that you're doing with the Indiana Ballet Conservatory. Thank you both so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Travis, so much.
Thanks, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with Indiana Ballet Conservatory's Alenia Yakaleva and Camille Nicodemus. The Indiana Ballet Conservatory will perform Cipollino at the Indianapolis Museum of Arts, the Toby, on May 12th at 2 and 7 p.m. More information at IndianaBalletConservatory.org.
Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
And they're off. There you go. It's Derby weekend.
That's why I'm wearing this hat. Can't you see the hat on the
radio? It's a lovely
hat
you have. And that's why I've got a mint julep waiting for
me
for afterwards. I see. So,
you may have to muddle that mint.
Yes. Well, all bets are off, unless you're betting on that calendar that we call
What'll We Do? We bet we'll have something that you'll want to go see or do.
What do you got on the post position there, Sharon?
Well, actually, here's something you might spend your winnings on. Lainey Kazan is coming to the Cabaret at the Columbia Club for a show May 11th and 12th. It's called I love this slant rhyme, The Chanteuse is Loose. The consummate entertainer, as funny as she is talented. So great voice, but also a great sense of humor, a great perspective on life. And you'll get as much of her philosophy as you will her lovely voice if you go hear that concert. May 11th and 12th, Lainey Kazan, Cabaret at the Columbia Club.
Very cool. Hey, something that just started this weekend that's a really neat event for artists in the area is the Indie Convergence, which is converging here in Indianapolis, down in Fountain Square at the Wheeler Arts Community. And it's a series of workshops and performances and rehearsals and things that bring together artists from all mediums. And it culminates in a free open lab performance on May 18th. But things are starting right now. In fact, on Friday night was one of the first events with Upland Brewery. But if you've missed that, then you can participate in events start on Monday. There's an improvisation mashup with dance, theater, and voice that's free that starts at 3:30 down at Wheeler. There's on Wednesday theater sustainability and design at the Phoenix Theater. The Art of the 30-Minute Rehearsal is going to be taking place Thursday at 6:30. It all goes on. There's dozens of free public events as well as other workshops for artists, actors, musicians, dancers. Check out indieconvergence.org for all the information. Most of the events are held at Wheeler Arts Community. Some are held at other events. Check out indieconvergence.org to find out what's going on right now.
Speaking of a convergence of talent and many disciplines, don't forget this coming Monday night, the performing arts community comes together again to stage one night of music, dance, theater, spoken word, and song at the Spotlight 2012 Seeing Red production. It's at Clues Memorial Hall at Butler University. Show starts at 7:30. The show includes two new acts from The Fourth Wall and the Transient Music Festival. Don't forget, all proceeds benefit the Indiana AIDS Fund, a program of the Health Foundation of Greater Indianapolis. And remember, every performer, technician, and stagehand will be donating his or her time and talent. So that's amazing and allows much more money to go to such great causes. If you don't have your tickets yet, go to spotlightindy.org, spotlightindy.org. And again, that's coming up on Monday night at 7:30, Clues Hall.
There's a lot of great theater that's opened recently, including Avenue Q over at the Phoenix and the Miracle Worker down at the IRT. But Saturday night is the last performance of Amusing Ambiguities, which is a Victorian Theater by Candlelight Company production taking place at the President Benjamin Harrison Home. And just a whole montage of mistaken motives and misunderstandings and, oh my goodness, and comedy ensues, taking place in sort of a salon style in different rooms throughout the President Benjamin Harrison Home. 8 o'clock is the show with performances of Ladies Man, Romance in a Flat, and Wooed and Viewed. Should be fun. Check out President Benjamin Harrison Home for that show Saturday night.
Travis, I'm going to keep you out of trouble and dozens more of our listeners who might not remember. Well, I'm going to try to anyway, keep you out of trouble.
Fair enough.
Who might not remember that there's a certain holiday coming up next week. A holiday that pretty much...
Mother's Day.
Yes,
thank you.
You forget that one.
I did not
you
forget
are, if you are, I suspect you probably have acquired some chocolates for your lovely mother,
yes,
since your wife
idea.
Is a chocolatier. Mm-hmm. However, here's something else you might want to do. If your mom likes experiences, the French Lick Springs Hotel is doing a special tour on Mother's Day. That's May 12th. That's next week, in case you haven't glanced at your digital calendar or whatever keeps you organized. Mm-hmm. You can follow that with an afternoon tea at the mansion built nearby in 1915 by the colorful Ed Ballard, a rags-to-riches one-time owner of the West Baden Springs Hotel. The afternoon tea menu, and I love this, and this is why I think of people's mothers, includes savories, finger sandwiches, breads, muffins, scones, pastries, and desserts with jam, lemon curd, and clotted cream.
Ooh, what delightful.
Yeah, so you can find out more about that Mother's Day event at 866-571-8687.
Very cool. Hey, something fun to do this Sunday on May 6th. You can even take your mom to it. It's an event that is taking place at the Earth House Collective. FarmersMarket.com presents Food Independence Day, a celebration of locally sourced food. And you'll have a chance to learn about and interact with speakers and local urban gardeners. And this is going to be a really cool event. Whole celebration of food starting at 4 p.m., including locally sourced food, urban gardens. Guest speakers include Andrew Brake of Keep Indianapolis Beautiful and Naptown Chickens, and Kara Dafford of You Relish, and Laura Fisher of The Bathroom Farmer. There you go, Sharon. You can't make a chicken sound for that one. It is a family-friendly celebration of food, and it should be a lot of fun. They're also going to have a screening of the award-winning film Fresh, and you're encouraged to bring some food, too, for the potluck.
Passing
check that out.
Farmer.
I'm just saying.
Okay.
You get the last word in, Sharon.
I'm a little concerned.
We're in the final stretch here.
We're
coming up.
Is it going to be a photo finish?
It could be a photo finish. Yeah.
Will my horse win by a nose?
We'll see. What do you got?
Is my last name Gamble? No, never mind.
You're making strides there.
Oh, my goodness. You once were a hoofer. The Indianapolis Museum of Art is about to reopen its newly redesigned galleries of African art on May 10th with a brand new, fresh approach to the display of more than 300 objects from the collection. And you can check that out again starting May 10th and maybe see things in a whole new way at the Indianapolis Museum of Art.
It's going to be very exciting. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we will be back with next winners on that calendar we called next week. What do we call, Sharon?
What do we do?
There we go. Photo finish.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
In 1986, the bronze medalist in the International Violin Competition of Indianapolis was a young Cuban-born performer named Andres Cardenas. Fast forward a quarter of a century and you can hear this Grammy-nominated artist on dozens of recordings. You can also hear him right here in Indianapolis at the Indiana History Center, where he'll play the Prokofiev Second Concerto with the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra on Saturday, May 12th at 8 p.m. Sharon Gamble invited the ICO's executive director, Elaine Eckhart, to our studios to learn more.
Well, you're kind of winding up the season with a big musical flourish with a partnership with the violin competition, right?
Oh, yes, we are. And the International Violin Competition of Indianapolis is an organization with whom we frequently partner. And we are able to present such very fine violinists, and we will be presenting one of their early laureates, bronze medalist from 1986, Mr. Andres Cardenas. So we are very excited to be welcoming him back to an Indiana stage.
He was a bronze medalist in, I believe that was only the second violin competition.
It was.
But he's been back since then. You were just saying before we turned the microphone on that that we know from recordings and hearing him in concert that he's a great musician, but he's also kind of a larger-than-life character.
Yes.
Kind of jolly and personable.
He's jolly and personable and has a, I guess you would say, a personality that fills the room. And I have to say, this is on hearsay, I've not met him yet, but he knows many musicians in the Indianapolis area, and specifically Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra musicians, personally, because he studied at Indiana University, as did many of our musicians.
Sure.
And I'd say maybe a half a dozen of them were at IU all at the same time.
Oh, my.
So that's why I said it's very exciting for us to welcome him back to an Indiana stage. It's going to be a little bit like Old Home Week, because the history with this guest artist goes really to the very start of his career. The other thing that I think is just so cool, I guess I like, you know, historical connections, is that Andres Cardenas was a student of Joseph Gingold's.
Mm-hmm.
And Joseph Gingold, as many of you probably, the listeners probably know, was the founding impetus for the International Violin Competition of Indianapolis. It was his vision. And so we are, to me, this is just kind of a full circle experience. And Cardenas went on to have a very distinguished career and was the concertmaster for the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra for many years and was really not available to concertize. He has recently retired, and he's back in the concertizing circles.
And that's awesome for listeners who have had to make do with recordings for a little while. He's also been doing some conducting, I understand.
I think he's pursuing, well, you know, he's gone on to the next step in a very distinguished career and is being, if you think about it, the concertmaster serving as the first chair is in some ways leading the orchestra. They're certainly leading the string sections. He's the one that's setting the bowings and making decisions about the presentation of the music, starting with the violins, but then it goes through the first violins, violas, cellos, and basses. They all take their markings and their guidance from the dictates of the concertmaster. So the conducting is just the next step.
He's the right-hand guy, or more accurately in most setups, the left-hand guy of the conductor already.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, the left-hand guy.
The left-hand
yes.
guy.
Uh-huh.
With his family, he has founded the Culver City Chamber Orchestra. He's the music director and founder and is doing some work on chamber music there. So you're right, it's kind of a whole new chapter for someone who is still has a lot of great musical years to go. The Prokofiev No. 2 Violin Concerto, difficult work, but listenable to somebody who maybe doesn't know it. Can you help us be a little less afraid of spiky Russian music?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, I think you said it pretty well. Listenable. You know, Prokofiev is newer among the four centuries in the body of classical music literature. Prokofiev would be considered new, as opposed to Bach or Vivaldi.
Just a youngster.
Yeah, just a youngster. And, you know, he epitomizes some of the characteristics that people would associate with Russian music, which has a real rich, sonorous, kind of a good heavy bass line, you know, the Russian basses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Prokofiev also has delighted audiences for years. I mean, think of him as very approachable with something like Peter and the Wolf. I mean, we all grow up knowing Prokofiev. And so...
And he has a sense of humor, a musical
yes.
sense of humor.
Mm-hmm. So I think the thing that is wonderful about, I find, you know, listening to these violin concertos by all of these different masters from all these different musical periods is... there's always an education in it for me. You know, it's the same 12 tones. And they are put together in such a construct. Even if you say, oh, well, you know, this has four movements, they are still put together in such harmonic constructs that every piece is a discovery. So... that is the context that I like to approach when I hear a piece from a composer with whom I'm less familiar, or a newer composer, a more whatever romantic or contemporary modern period composer,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to what the chamber orchestra audience would be, those old faithfuls. You know, you always know what you're getting with Mozart and Bach.
I never thought of it that way, but that's true.
Yeah, yeah. So
it's a known brand.
So, no, I think there will be, some turns in the music that people go, oh, but I think there will also find, you know, that it's pleasing and there'll be melodies and things like that. So people are not going to be smacked with something that's atonal. And,
and you know, Kirk is, it strikes me as a programmer that he's very careful and very nurturing of his audience, because he always, if he features something that's more modern or maybe a little bit less familiar, he always bookends it with something that is more accessible. In the case of this concert, the Haydn Symphony No. 99, which was the one of the set of the 12 so-called London symphonies,
mm-hmm,
and
right.
although it was composed in Vienna, I believe, and it was the first Haydn symphony I read this to use clarinet, so that's kind of fun.
Oh, now there, I learned something. I didn't know that.
And you know, the wind and brass instrumentalists get a little bit of a rest during the Schrecker intermezzo. Franz Schrecker, who seems to be a bit of a favorite of Kirk's.
Yes, yes, and that's, you know, yeah, which is one of the things that I really love about Kirk Trevor's programming is because. When I was first coming to the chamber orchestra, you know, just as a patron, as a concert goer, and now even as an employee of the chamber orchestra, I leave the programming to Kirk. This is his area of expertise, and he just really knows how to dig in that bag and pull out interesting combinations. And he will pull them out from multiple periods in the history of music, you know, so you rarely will get something that's just all Baroque period or all classical period, or even when we do occasionally do a contemporary concert, he will usually try to pepper something in there that if it's a contemporary work that maybe was patterned or inspired by something that came out of an earlier, a Mozart inspired or a class Romantic period inspired, so that listeners can make the musical link. You know, music is evolutionary. And also just to not to be assaulting one's ears.
Sure.
Sometimes it's hard. I mean, really, even for music lovers, we all like to listen to what we love. And it's to listen to new music, to something that's new, stretches you a little bit. So a whole concert of new music can sometimes be just a little challenging.
It kind of rings you out at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yes.
But it's good to keep in mind, too, that even the most beloved piece was new to you at some point.
Right.
So
that's
you have
right.
to give it a chance. And, you know, it's so interesting. I've had this conversation several times with people who think, I just don't really care for classical music. And it's like, well, really? Well, because it's new and I've never heard those combination of notes before or whatever. It's like, well, do you listen to pop radio? Yeah. Well, what do you do when a new song comes on? Do you just change the station?
Right.
You know, so at some point that song that you listen to the first time becomes familiar, just as that symphony
mm-hmm.
Or string orchestra intermezzo becomes familiar. So you kind of have to take a chance.
Yes, you do. I don't think I am going to be repeating myself, and I'm not going to be able to give you, because this was so long ago that when I read it, all the particulars, but this is the gist of what I read. To this is the response to those who kind of don't like classical music or find it unapproachable. And the writer of this piece had said, well, if you like Led Zeppelin, you'll probably like Wagner. If you like the Beatles, you probably will like Mozart. And the premise of this article was taking the popular music and kind of looking at the structure of it and building its genealogy, if you will, back to the classical music, which essentially all of the music from whatever the 1600s to today has all been evolutionary based on these pieces. So it's very interesting.
That's what Pandora needs to start doing. If you set up your Led Zeppelin station, it needs to start pulling in some Wagner. Who do we write to
yes,
about this?
Yes, yes, yes. Maybe, yes. Let's start integrating. That's right.
I love it. I love it. Hey, speaking of new, what can you tell us about the new season?
Okay. Well, not quite ready to make an announcement yet, but
okay.
I do think we've
there
got
some...
There
might be a new venue on the horizon? Can you talk about that?
No, I
we'll
can't.
We'll have to invite you
yes,
back.
Yes, you're
okay.
going to have to invite me back. But there might be a new venue on the horizon. So,
yay.
Yeah, so keep that one. First of all, we will deliver another 7-concert series of really variety-packed, intimate classic original concerts. And we will be back at some of our favorite venues. We will be back at the Indianapolis Museum of Art with a silent film.
Yay.
That'll be in April again next year. And don't have the film selected yet, so don't know what that film will be. We will be back at the Athenaeum Theater with a classic or with a cabaret style Pops concert. And I probably can spill these beans. We'll be featuring Stephen Stolen, who's very, you know, popular tenor here in
especially
town.
Especially at WFYI.
Yes, yes, our Stolen Moments man. And Spencer Meyer, who is an American Pianist Association.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I won't announce, I'll keep you in suspense okay. on the repertoire that Spencer Meyer is going to play, because we want to make sure that we can acquire it. But so that's, and then we will be opening the season with a wonderful young violinist, Caroline Goulding. So that gives you just kind of a little smattering of what, and oh, and we will be doing Handel's Messiah, and hope to have it expanded just a tad with a sing-along at the wonderful Indiana Landmark Center.
Ooh. Love those sing-along messiahs.
Yes.
They're just such a treat. And for anybody who's never been to one is going, ew, no. No, it's fascinating.
Oh, it is
it's
fascinating.
So much fun.
And that is a really fine facility, and it's the structure of it in the round really lends itself for everybody to be a part of the concert. So we'll still be doing our traditional two Saturday night, Sunday night, and the sing-along will happen on Monday. So that's probably, you know, I want to be careful about other venues and guest artists. I guess Indiana Landmarks, that's a new venue.
There you go. And so, we'll have you back to talk about more when you can.
Yes, yes.
Sharon Gamble with Elaine Eckhart, Executive Director of the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. You can hear Andres Cardenas play the second Prokofiev Violin Concerto with the ICO on Saturday, May 12th at 8 p.m. at the Indiana History Center. Kirk Trevor conducts the concert, which also features Franz Schirker's Intermezzo and Haydn's Symphony No. 99. Learn more at icomusic.org. Again, icomusic.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4, when I'll talk with Brooklyn Copeland about her new poem book, Siphon Harbor.
I'll find out what's going on at the Indianapolis School of Ballet.
And I'll chat with pianist Becky Archibald. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.